Welcome to Unpacking the Digital Shelf, where we explore brand manufacturing in the digital age. Hey everyone, Peter Crosby here from the Digital Shelf Institute. One of the DSI's most popular webinars in our direct-to-consumer series was this conversation I was lucky enough to have with James Seidel, VP of Digital Commerce at McCormick. I love McCormick's vision to bring flavor to the meals of every consumer on the planet. And even more, I love their vision for digital commerce, make every moment shoppable. And their D2C strategy is a key component of delivering on that vision. Here's that conversation. So James, let's start with the business case for D2C. What's the D2C why for McCormick?
So when you think about a lot of the disruption that's been happening from a retailer landscape standpoint, even pre-COVID, you know, creating a direct-to-consumer platform was really a means of driving a much broader digital marketing strategy for us, which is about creating more intimate and one-to-one relationships through our digital experiences. So as you think about direct-to-consumer, that was one way of us managing some of that disruption, but it's also another means of just getting some really rich learning. As you think about, you know, what you can learn about consumers, learn about building relationships with consumers through a transactional platform. And for us, that's a shoppable platform. And how you can engage with brands and really think about, you know, simply a means of creating other valuable branded experiences as part of a broader relationship. It's not just about the sale online. It's about how do you, you know, really make those meaningful. And, you know, that said, you know, more and more consumers are expecting frictionless one-click shopping experiences. And that's really helped shape our thinking as well as our vision for making all branded moments shoppable. And we're not where we want to be yet. This is a journey.
You're not perfect yet.
We're not perfect yet. But that vision really became our beacon for where we want to go with direct to consumer. And it's, like I said, it's provided us a lot of really rich learning experiences that we're applying back to some of our core business, applying back to our agile innovation initiatives, our CRM, social channels, and really other communications for the brand.
Yeah, so much of D2C, right, is getting yourself into an agile environment where the wheel is always turning, the learnings are always happening, and having that sort of feedback loop set up, and it can be really valuable, yeah? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So given that why, you know, you had kind of a, your first big experience in D2C was kind of a be careful what you wish for kind of moment. You might get it, right? And your CEO has talked about this on CNBC, but Old Bay hot sauce, you sold out in 24 hours. Just walk us through that sort of early stage experience and what you took away from it besides maybe an ulcer or, yeah, what happened there?
Yeah, like I said, very much in the early stages of our direct-to-consumer journey, but we've learned a lot in a very short period of time. I think the internal step that we actually sold out in less than about an hour, believe it or not, and it crashed the site, which was really good learning for us. But Old Bay Hot Sauce launched back in January this year, and it was a limited edition. So people that are maybe not familiar with what it is, it was a limited edition hot sauce that was created in partnership with our branded food service business. And what that original launch was actually a pre-seed. And it was part of a pre-seeding with restaurants through our branded food service business. And we said, you know, here's an opportunity for us maybe to create some early on buzz and do some sampling online. And we used the direct-to-consumer platform that we had launched a few months beforehand as a platform for creating some additional consumer awareness in trial before the retailer launch, which was certainly planned a little bit later. But the nature of being a limited edition and pre-seeding, we had limited quantities of product. And there's really no way with this platform, we're not at a place where we're sophisticated enough to be able to think about DTC forecasting, right, that we've got on our core business. So there was not much really guiding us in terms of how quickly we're going to sell through. And that's where a lot of this learning from the very start, it was a much bigger success. It got a lot of buzz. The final stat, we got over a billion impressions overall.
Holy cow.
Which is pretty exciting and pretty mind-blowing at the end of the day. And that was not just the Mid-Atlantic, which I think also speaks to the power of, you know, where your brand followers are and where your brands are sometimes in unexpected and not necessarily always in obvious places. So when it did launch as part of our pre-seeding plan, the story got picked up nationally, and that really accelerated. And I think when we looked at, we're following this live within about an hour after that getting picked up, the traffic on the site had such a surge that it was literally about 30 minutes or so. And it was by the end of the day, we had people reselling it on eBay and open marketplaces for much, much more than we were originally selling it. But it showed the power of bringing together really, I think, a beloved brand together with passionate users and consumers, social media, together with our restaurant partners, but then also that shoppable brand in sight, because they had an outlet to go that they didn't have to wait anymore. And it certainly generated a lot of excitement. And at a point where once we did sell out, we had over 50,000 consumers sign up for notifications when we were going to be available later.
Wow, a 50,000 email list.
Yes, which was a good learning for us when you think about building out, you know, people that are proactively opting in for a branded site. Yeah. Pretty exciting to us. But at the same time, we wanted to make sure that, you know, you want to build a relationship. You want to respect them. You want to make sure that we're not going to disappoint those people, right, you know, once we do have products available. And we felt it was really critical to make sure that people were notified as well. You just think about just being a good communicator in a relationship. You want to make sure that we as a brand were proactively communicating so that we're helping kind of manage those expectations with consumers. So we got inventory back in and launched officially, both in retail as well as direct consumer on June 22nd. And we decided to cascade communications out over time. So people still had, you know, quote unquote, kind of exclusive access to some of the product if they wanted to sign up for it from the pre-seeding. But we wanted to make sure that was an optimal user experience because it's delicate when you think about that, right? Like, people that had signed up and we wanted to make sure that they were going to get the product and certainly be happy because it's a fantastic product. And it was also launching in brick and mortar as well. So we also thought through, look, if we can't get enough product for those people and their networks, we also wanted to be able to guide them to other places where they could buy it, which is also part of our plan. So, you know, we were really surprised as we watched the orders come in live after June 22nd, and they were really spread across the entire U.S. So it was not just a Mid-Atlantic thing. It was not just a Maryland thing. I mean, this was really pretty widespread as you think about where consumers were looking for this kind of a product. So that was one exciting piece of it, but it also gave us some insight into where our consumer base and where our fan base really is for that brand.
I mean, I love the fact that it started with a partnership with your food service teams, that bridging. And was that an unusual partnership to be sort of crossing the silos a bit in that way? Or was that something you normally do? It's just you brought this D2C element to it.
We're doing more and more of that. And particularly with the RB Foods acquisition, we're trying to drive more and more scale. The idea certainly came out of branded food service, and we saw started having the conversations internally between brand and service together with the consumer business and said, there's a bigger opportunity here. And that's really where we brought in the idea of going direct to consumer, as well as strengthening those relationships through our restaurant partners.
So I would imagine, you know, as VP of digital commerce, you probably have to do a lot of inside your organization education and cheerleading for the value of digital. And I was just wondering, could you turn around and say, yeah, I told you this would work? Or was the Old Bay Hot Sauce experience a chance to maybe bring some people onto the sort of selling direct side that maybe had either not seen the light or wasn't sure that it would actually impact the business sufficiently to be worth the investment or anything like that?
Sure. I think it was certainly a proof point. Yeah. The potential of using shoppable moments, of using a direct-to-consumer platform to build a relationship, and certainly was, you know, successful in that sense. Yeah. But we're very much early on in this journey. But you know, one of the things that we did do was also look at some of the external case studies and bringing outside learning in. You know, looking at what were other companies doing in this space to try to get pretty smart about this before we launched into it. You know, I engaged with several different consultants in this space, read a lot of white papers, talked to a lot of peer companies about their journey along the way. But that said, you know, we moved pretty quickly in the sense that we had our first version of this platform, or the first iteration of this platform, back in November 2018. And it was really launched within a matter of a few months. And in hindsight, you know, I think we'd do it all over again. I'm not saying it was certainly not perfect. And that is a mind shift for us, not always having to be perfect, particularly if you're using this as a learning platform together with a shoppable or sales platform as well. And we've gone through a lot of different iterations about what that site needs to look like, but also trying to get the right value proposition such that you can drive people to a branded site, and just understanding the why behind that.
Yeah, you really, so much of it is involved in, it goes back to the business case, really, like, what is the differentiation you're going to introduce in that experience that sets it apart from what they can do out in the retailer channels that are important customers for you and that are important ways to reach your consumers. So it's not like it is not the either. It's doing all those things well and deciding what that interaction is. And is that something you're still investigating? Is that a constant?
We're still learning. I would say I talk about we're constantly in beta mode in this business. Yeah. So the mindset of quickly testing and learning. So when we first got started, like many other CPGs, we started with gifting and bundling and trying to find that unique value proposition. That is not, however, a longer term, more repeatable business. It's actually important for our category as you think about gifting and a lot of seasonality around the fourth quarter. So it was a good start for us. And actually, when we launched the site, it was right around that time. But when you think about something like Old Bay Hot Sauce, that's a prime example of where McCormick and our brands can give a unique value proposition. And we're continuing to explore more and more of those types of product initiatives such that you can continue to build that relationship and you can continue to use it as a means of creating a branded experience through a shoppable platform. And you know, the other thing that I would say is we're constantly trying to learn and get better. Technology plays a really key role in this, and we've had a lot of learning about how you can use technology so that the branded experience all the way through checkout and delivery is easy. And it's not, you know, just removing barriers and removing problems actually along the way are really a key enabler for making what we want to make all branded moments shoppable. But we didn't necessarily fully appreciate that, I think, early on in our journey. So you also asked about, you know, continuing to sell this in. We've had to do a lot of reframing. meaning reframing the opportunity for a lot of our internal stakeholders. And some of that has been about how do you think about using a shoppable platform as just an additional branded touch point and as part of the branded experience. So we needed to move from kind of multi-year planning in many ways to launching within, like I said, like this beta mentality and a beta mindset. So we simply stopped talking about it as a branded selling platform, and we started talking about it just as another branded experience or another branded moment within a relationship. And that shifted our conversations to be more about what are the tactics that we want to go after and more about how does this platform support our broader digital ecosystem. And one of the examples that I think that just to bring it home with a real life example, is, you know, grilling season last year. So that's one of our key selling periods during the year. And we started with a hypothesis. So think about what's your hypothesis, how are you gonna prove it out, how are you gonna measure it? And how do we just make it easier for consumers to find grilling products and recipes that are already being promoted online as part of our grilling plans? And that led us to different options for those products and how do we drive people through that branded experience onto a DTC site? And really a simple principle just from online shopping overall. And frankly, it worked. And our conversion KPIs started to improve overall. So we started with, and sometimes from a tactical standpoint, sometimes it's just making buy now or buy here available on the right products on our branded site that you can then turn into a shoppable moment. So that's one example. You know, another is, you think about tapping into the branded ecosystem, social, and in our category, social was a really important engagement point for consumers. And, you know, we started digging into what are people saying about some of our brands and our products on the site, or through some of our social channels, which has also led to new product insights that we're using direct to consumer. Whether that be through bundling existing products or completely new products and leading them to the direct to consumer site.
Yeah, I mean, I think it all goes, when you talk about sort of the difference between thinking of it as a brand selling platform versus just another experience in the journey, it just goes back to how much the consumer is in charge of their own journey now. And so they, to your making every brand moment shoppable, they get to decide when they want to press that, when they're ready to press a buy button or a learn more button or a search bar. And so you want to be, I would imagine, available to offer them the options that they want in that moment everywhere. And we're still in the early stages of being able to make that happen, you know, just technologically, let alone procedurally, process-wise. But it's an exciting future to be able to think about that, because to your point, any friction can result in a lost sale. And so the more across the ecosystem we can reduce that friction, the more successful, I think, the happier consumer you'll have and the more successful business.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
So you talked a bit about technology. Can you go a little bit into the tech stack that you're using to power your direct relationships?
So tech was a big shift for us just as an organization, as you think about what's needed to be able to have shoppable moments and sell directly to consumers. So I mentioned that we went really fast in the beginning. And what we did was, a few months into it, we actually slowed down a little bit because we wanted to make sure that our tech stack was supporting the ambition that we had much longer term. And we brought some outside thinking in to help us look at different options, evaluate several different platforms. But that really proved to be an essential step for us. Now, again, we haven't realized the full potential of the choices that we've made, but very early signs are showing that because of some of the changes that we have made in our tech stack, it is creating more frictionless checkout, for example. That was one of the challenges that we had very earlier on. It's enabling a better kind of browsing experience on the site. And even important things like shipping and tracking all the way to home. And having those capabilities in your tech stack is now really going to help us unlock a lot of the plans that we have in order to get to our longer term ambition. And you know, I have to give a lot of credit to, this is one of my own personal learnings coming out of this, is collaborating with our IT organization very early on, bringing them along in the journey about what that ambition is and how do we get there. They've been incredibly agile throughout this the process and some of the changes that we made. And I think it's actually one of the functions that really and quickly picked up what that commercial imperative was. Mm-hmm. Direct to consumer business and really rallied behind the plan. We're in a much better place. So early wins, just to give you an example, are not only the structure of how we've organize that site, but even with just improving that checkout experience, we've seen improvements in overall conversion and our abandonment rate, which is exciting to see because we're just trying to scratch the surface.
Yeah, it's a couple of thoughts there. You know, you can sort of do marketplaces as a Skunk Works thing without maybe IT necessarily knowing that it's happening. I'm not offering that as advice. I'm just saying it's possible. You really can't do a direct to consumer site, even if you're doing like a Shopify or a big commerce. I think you need your IT partners at your side because the implications across your systems of shipping eaches and all that, I would imagine are pretty complex.
Yes. Yeah.
And also I think choosing the technology partners, I would imagine the accent probably is on the word partnership because this is changing so quickly. The technologies that you're investing in, I would imagine, you need to have confidence that they will be changing with the speed of that and can bring you along through that journey. It's, you know, it's no more probably the monoliths of the world that are going to solve these problems. It's maybe the more nimble technology partners. Are you finding that?
I think it's for us, at least it's probably a combination of both. Yeah. So we want to leverage and get as much that we can out of our existing capabilities, out of strategic partners that we have on the tech side, as well as working with and learning from third parties that are much more agile. You know, things that, just to give you an example, things like fulfillment and tapping into third parties that do have an expertise in dropship and in very agile things to be able to create those unique experiences for consumers that oftentimes are outside of shipping pallets and more about an each mentality. And that's where we have partnered with other third parties, and it's been really good learning. I think we're getting smarter. We're not all the way there yet.
Yeah, I'll just remind everyone that the Q&A tab is open. So if you want to pop questions in, please do so. James, I'd love to move to as you said, the D2C stuff is just one part of your overall channel strategy. And when you thought about your direct to consumer channel strategy, I mentioned marketplaces earlier. Did you start with marketplaces first, or was branded site always the objective that you have? And how does that fit into your overall channel strategy?
As we define digital commerce within McCormick, it really falls into three buckets. Direct to consumer being one of them, but it's also a pure play marketplace strategy, as well as omnichannel. And what I mean by that is the brick and mortar digital properties that we sell through as well. So it's very much all three. I think as you think about, oftentimes CPGs will start with both marketplaces as well as omni, and I hear a lot of conversation externally as well as internally that a lot of people think about all three of those as a zero-sum game. And that has not necessarily been our experience. Now, COVID and the pretty massive shift in shopping behavior has certainly accelerated a lot of this. But what we're seeing is that you can actually create broader category growth across all three with the right strategies and the right plan and execution. So even though we've seen pretty massive acceleration as a result of COVID, much of it is certainly coming from those changing shopping habits, but the data that we're seeing is also that it's not likely going to go away, and therefore people are having a very positive online shopping experience, and therefore it's likely going to turn into repeat. And for us, that's a broader category growth story. So we have made the choice that we want to have a presence and support all three of those different buckets, and do that with best-in-class content, do that with on platform investments, on retailer platform investments, as well as different digital shopper programs and the right innovation across those different channels.
And I would imagine that the intelligence you're able to bring from your learnings in D2C and bring to your retail experiences with your retail partners must be a beneficial, you know, you are coming to them when you bring a new product or something like that to them, that your learnings from those test and learns bring a better result potentially on your retailer platforms?
That's right. I think new product innovation is one example of that where we have been able to do it. I think there are several examples around content. And, you know, I mentioned social as another example of where we're mining insights from our social channels and bringing those back and impacting. So back to like an NPD example or a new product example, we are using searches as one way of identifying different product ideas. And we're using that in a way to also make the case for not only launching through e-commerce and our direct-to-consumer platforms, but it's, I think retailers more and more are recognizing that that is also building points of proof for potential expansion in market success. You know, the most rapid example is Old Bay Hot Sauce, but there are also other examples out there of where we've used this model and it's been successful for expansion.
So Ricky, I think in this context, we have a question coming in. How did you handle going from a B2B company to a B2C company? Did you have pushback with company systems not integrating smoothly into the D2C platforms?
Smoothly is not necessarily the right word.
Those pesky adjectives.
I think it comes back to, you know, when we originally launched, it came back to, we needed to do an assessment of what are we going to use, what are we going to leverage out of our existing capabilities. And then we recognized that there were certainly gaps. I think the example that I shared with our tech platform and our tech stack up against the direct-to-consumer platform is probably one example where we said we're probably going to need a different solution and identify something that's going to help us get there. You know, the other thing that I would mention going from B2B to B2C, our innovation model needed to be different. So I mentioned using search as an example of how do we use search that is already in market demand, essentially is how I think about it, and turn that into product ideas. But we can't give the same rigor outside of things that are non-negotiables like food safety and all those kind of the right things to do, but how do we quickly get into market with product ideas that we know we already have a demand for? So we created an agile innovation team to remove some of the things that were slowing us down and give the appropriate amount of rigor behind taking ideas and getting them into market faster.
Yeah, I mean, that goes to the organizational willingness to test and learn and building those muscles, which may or may not, depends on the organization, have been in place prior to needing to adjust to this new opportunity. So how did you develop these muscles at McCormick's and how do you use the metrics and the data that you get out of it to keep that virtuous cycle going?
So within McCormick, we have a pillar called Driven to Innovate. It's part of fundamental part of our business and our culture. For this work in particular, though, we really needed to shift the mindset to be much more of a beta mode mindset. And knowing that there was not any one playbook for success, particularly within our category, we needed to get functions and people comfortable with being a little bit more uncomfortable. And that started with creating a structure for how we're going to take ideas, turn them into tangible experiments, pause, evaluate it, learn, and then iterate. And we applied an approach in McCormick that is called the smallest executable step. So the idea being, don't think about just yet multi-million dollar platforms that you want to launch, but think about what's something that you can test today that can be small, but can give you learning that can get you up to the multi-million dollar platform. And because it's very easy to fall into the same processes and the same behaviors that the rest of the business has. And those are all there for a purpose and they have their role, right? To mitigate risk and make sure that we're maximizing the opportunity. But in these platforms, we needed to break through that mold a little bit. And that's why we needed to think differently. We created a smaller, more agile team to be able to go after that. And we worked in sprints. And what that did was we go through a sprint, we do the hypotheses, we test it, and then we quickly learn in a matter of weeks about how an idea, a bundle, a product idea is working in market. And then we'd iterate it. And then that gave us confidence, okay? And it gave the organization some confidence that this can work and that there's then, you can see where scale can come on the horizon.
And certainly in your category specifically, food quality and safety is paramount. And I'm sure, I think you're proving that you can do that and still obviously keep to the rules and make sure that your product is safe and right. That's an important part of your mission.
That's right. And that's, we take quality very seriously and certainly food safety. So those are not things that we negotiate on. Those are non-negotiables for us if you think about any kind of innovation. But what is negotiable is how quickly you can take something that maybe a formula or a path or a communication that's already been proven out and how do you quickly get these into these platforms for testing.
So once these muscles start to get going and you got your first kind of successes from the testing model, how did that change the way you were able to work?
So one of the things it did is we started to get some points on board or proof points in this model is we didn't have to ask for as much permission. So going back to some of the questions about B2B, B2C, in a large scalable business, there's a different mentality of how you mitigate risk. We were able to start proving that out in a small way and get some of those successes. And by the way, failures too. We've had some small failures that we've learned from that we've then been able to iterate and turn them into actually some better ideas at the end of the day. So things like product bundles, we've tested a subscription plan, we've tested different product forms based on some of the search insights. We found new ways to kind of bring back more loyal consumers for harder find yet very passionate and loyal following items, believe it or not. And it's really challenged conventional thinking and made some functions pretty uncomfortable. As you think about, it's not just about a traditional route to market and a traditional qualification plan. And it's kind of turned that on its head. And that's how we've been able to garner some of the wins within the organization. But we're getting very, very close. And I'd say just scratching the surface yet in that sense. I think part of what we need to continue to learn about is how we continue to look at data differently, which think about a large B2B business and how do you look at data through a B2C lens is different. And we're just getting started in that sense.
And one of the questions, and I should say with these questions that are coming in live, of course, we respect any confidentiality. So you can choose to answer them or not, but I'm going to throw some of them at you. And thanks for doing that. Christina asked, do you have any KPIs or success measures that straddle across all three digital commerce platforms?
So KPIs that go across all three, yes. And they're not going to be, I think, anything proprietary. It's going to be top line sales. We measure across all. We also look very closely at conversion rates. because you think about different investments and levers across each one of them. We do have KPI set up around conversion. And I'd also look at, I'd also say loyalty is another one that tends to go across kind of all three of those.
So there's another interesting question here. It made me wonder. So someone said that your D2C site looks like a separate site from your content sites. How did you decide to do that? Did you find that your existing traffic site is going into the shop site, or do you have to drive separate traffic? Like, how do those work together?
So I would say our end state will be much more seamless. But I think it's a fair observation, as there are some things that look and feel a little bit different. I think that's, there's still some things that we're working through. But our longer term view is that it look and feel very consistent. And it'd be remiss, actually, going back to the other question, but content and having appropriate content KPIs and metrics and making sure that you've got the right content in the right place across all of them. So I think that also plays into the content that we're serving up on our branded site, as well as on the shop, which is embedded within the McCormick.com site, that it does need to look and feel very similar. Some of the choices that we've made with some of the tech changes over the past few months have started to enable that. You know, the other observation that you're probably gonna see is we've got, from an assortment standpoint, we don't have 100% connectivity back with every product that is on the .com site yet. You know, part of that is a lot of the disruption that we're living through now with COVID. However, as you think about the capability to be able to put in place, creating any recipe that can be shoppable, any product that shows up that a consumer would be interested in shopping, a lot of that connectivity is part of the ambition that we have and where we want to go. But it's a fair observation.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure many of the brands on this call are trying to figure out that same thing. We have this thing, but over here we need to move fast and try things. And you may, to your point, you may need to keep them separate and then figure out how to bring them together over time and be willing as an organization to sort of live with that discomfort. I think, you know, even as a technology provider in my day job, I feel those those pains sometimes. So I totally understand. There's one question that's coming in here. D2C is an investment, and it can challenge profitability for businesses. And one of the attendees asked, sort of, how did you tackle this originally? Like, how do you think about that as an investment?
I think you need to take a long-term view. It's my short answer. And what I mean by that is a long-term view is you would think about a branded experience investment. Okay, and creating branded experiences should have both short-term ROI metrics as well as longer-term brand building metrics. So the view that we do take is we want to build out this business as quickly as possible, but know that it is going, there's no hockey stick, at least in our model, for that type of growth. This is likely a business that we are going to continue to build. And as you get the flywheel going, for our branded owned and operated platforms, and then turning that into shoppable moments for us, that's the longer term view that we're taking.
I think it's super important, and it can be a challenge in these unknown areas, and when there's an established part of the business that's bringing in the bulk of the revenue, how you think about balancing that and investing in the long-term and shareholder value. I mean, I'm sure those are all very complex conversations. Interesting question from KJC. Are your customers okay paying shipping, going to sort of the cost of doing business and expectations? Has that been a barrier for you?
I don't think they're that... that different than what you would see in an open marketplace. Knowing that this is a branded site, I do think there's a bit of different consumer expectations for that. However, we have taken learning from our open marketplace business to understand that shipping, if you can remove that as a barrier, we should. And so that's where we do have certain thresholds. We've done some testing around offering free shipping on various types of order amounts. And it has proven out to be pretty close to where open marketplaces and that type of behavior actually is showing up. So when you think about scaling, we would love to have, you know, higher average selling prices at the end of the day, because that will help certainly with our financial model to be able to pay that out.
Earlier, you talked about the sum, that it wasn't a zero-sum game and that the sum was greater than the sum of its parts. Niru asked, how do you define incrementality of digital efforts, particularly for marketplace and direct-to-consumer?
So if you're talking about incrementality from a sales standpoint, and I'm assuming that's where the question is going, we look at it independent of channel and customer. And that's where we're seeing, when I talk about category growth, we're seeing broader category growth across multiple channels. How do we define that? We look at things like household penetration, we look at unique visitors, we look at unique purchases with the data that we have to be able to understand, is this a completely new shopper? Or is this a repeat shopper potentially from another channel? So there are ways that we do look at that. And particularly with grocery and particularly over the last 6 months, we have seen a lot of increases overall in grocery shopping online, which we're benefiting from as the entire category is benefiting from. But we're also seeing, particularly with home cooking and where most of our products play a role in home cooking, that's not just a spike. We're seeing a lot of ongoing consumption as a result of that. So that's where we're seeing a lot of the incremental consumption. We're seeing that across channels. We're seeing that disproportionately in these channels.
And before we close out, James, I just want to go, Jake asked a question, and I think I mentioned the mission of having every moment be shoppable. And I kind of glossed over it. I didn't kind of ask you to define it, but in McCormick parlance, what does a shoppable moment mean?
So a shoppable moment, as we define it, is any branded touch point that could be a click away from a transaction.
A click away from a transaction.
Is very simple as that. And that's how I talk about it internally within the organization. So when you look at our properties today, we're not there yet. But you can think about the potential of once you start bringing that kind of a vision to life across our owned and operated platforms.
I love the vision. And I think I imagine that focuses so much of your strategy conversations and also investment decisions when you return to that North Star. I think that's so important when you're innovating like this.
It is, Peter. And one other thing I would say, as a B2B business that's going into B2C, you have a lot of assets that you can use to be able to get to that vision that a startup doesn't necessarily have.
Yeah.
And that can be really, for us, that is really powerful in the sense of how do we take a really highly engaged audience and going back to the Old Bay hot sauce example, people that want to engage with us, and that's not always paid. Okay, they're paying in other ways. They're paying in terms of your data and the brand.
Yeah. And I think it also is a way to engage, a highly motivated workforce that believes in the products that you're bringing to market. It channels their efforts. And I would imagine the excitement, as sort of harrowing as it might be sometimes when sites go down or something, the excitement of knowing that you're innovating your relationship with the consumer and they're responding must be super gratifying.
It is. And I think a lot of the engagement through social that we've seen, some of it sometimes was early on was a little bit negative, but you got to take that, but we learned from it. And that's why I talk about what we learned from the time that we did the pre-seeding through following up with having the right inventory. You need to be able to continue to have a conversation with consumers and then certainly deliver on the promises that the brand is in. And in our case, that was make sure that the product was available through our properties.
So Ricky Busby, who was on our last webinar from Georgia Pacific, who was very kind about contributing their path to D2C. He asks, how does your vision for D2C connect back to and support each brand's marketing objectives? And it sounds like D2C and Shoppable Moments are a key part of all of their brands, or are some in different points of maturity, or how do you sort of handle those connections?
I think you said it. There are different places. However, I would say over the past year or so, we've made some intentional choices about making sure that we're integrating not only direct to consumer, but also online shopping and our marketplace and digital fundamentals as part of our overall brand plans, which has been a pretty major shift for us. And certainly the marketplace is responding, consumers are responding, we're seeing the changes in shopping behavior as a result. So we've been ready for that.
So this is the last one we have time for. Back to the idea of first party data. How does the value of first party data fit into your overall strategy? And are you using acquired first party data to inform marketing, targeting, et cetera?
So I think I mentioned we're very much at the beginning of this. We made some major tech choices and tech stack choices over the past few months that are just starting to give us first party data. I would say what has been a key learning for us is being intentional about how you want to mine assets and the analytical capabilities that you need to put up against those and planning ahead for those. So what are the questions and hypotheses you want to answer? And then getting the right people internally, particularly from a data analytics standpoint, to understand how we're going to answer them with that first party data. So I know that's not a complete simple answer. It's just we're very much getting started there with first party data through that platform.
Well, thanks for answering these questions that are coming at you fast and hard. I really appreciate that. And just to close out, you're talking to yourself 2 years ago and all the lessons that you've learned. What advice would you give to your prior James that you've learned along the way?
I think it's grounded in this idea of a B2B going to a B2C. You need to take a long-term view on this disruption, but you need to act with a lot of urgency and learn and be curious about what is possible for the brand, because that has been critical for us to know things that were not obvious at the beginning, but it just took a lot of curiosity and thinking much longer term about this opportunity.
And I know you wouldn't say this, but it requires a leader who's willing to invest in the relationships and the communication and the constant transparency to make that vision come to life throughout the organization. So thank you. And part of that is sharing back out. And at the DSI, like, we are so grateful for anybody that takes the time to share back out what they've learned along the way. And it's a really generous act. And James, I really appreciate you being part of this series.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
Thanks again to James for contributing his expertise to the DSI. Please share this episode with your colleagues and leave us a review wherever you get your podcast. Thanks for being part of our community.